This was an interview I did with Giles Slade, who's the author of The Big Disconnect for Alternatives Journal. Without further ado, just because we're running tight on time, we're going to go to the interview, but there will be full show notes on it on after the program. So without further ado, here's Giles Slade. One of the things that was the biggest theme of sort of all of your work is that, I haven't seen you described this way, but I would put you very much as a social critic. Would you disagree with that assessment?
I guess not. I started writing these because I wondered, how we'd got into this mess, and I didn't really even have a very concrete way to describe the mess. I was trying to describe the mess as I was trying to sort of explain it historically, and so. Yeah, it's become social criticism, and at least in one dimension, and that's I guess the reason for either my limited popularity or my massive unpopularity. I'm not trying to write Jeremy ads or anything like that, but I think we've invented this terrible way of living, and compared to other cultures that I've lived in, I've lived in six countries. We've sort of painted ourselves into a corner, and so I want to know, how we did that, what precisely, the corner is all about, and how to get out of it.
So your most recent book, The Big Disconnect, talks a lot about the social disconnect of, among other things, among many things. You talk a lot about music and the invention of the gramophone and just even the concept of portable music. You also get into more recent modern day developments, things like Facebook and Twitter and all these sorts of things. Can you just describe quickly the effect what actually has happened? What has happened to society and to interpersonal relationships due to Facebook? I kind of understand. And I'm not quite as clear on where the gramophone comes in, if you want to just explain that.
Yeah, okay. Well, that's just a very specific example of how we have invented and used technology to support and encourage our social isolation. There's this broad sort of historical curve from, maybe the 1830s, 1850s onwards, where cities increased in size. People, more and more people, moved into cities from the country and of course, from other countries. And as this was happening, we invented technologies to sustain the connection that we once had with the families that we left in our countries or in the old countries. And so photographs, telephone calls, gramophone records, which were originally used to send messages, all came up, in a very close period of time in the maybe 1860s, 1870s, and so technology became a way to divert ourselves from our loneliness. And as our increasing invention of these kinds of technologies took hold, and as we became acclimatized to them, we began to use them increasingly to divert ourselves. Both from the feelings of loneliness and isolation that we experienced in the new environment of the city, and also to prevent ourselves from making new connections because these diversions became increasingly good, satisfying, and powerful. And so, when you walk across the urban grid listening to your iPhone or your iPad listening to music, you're getting the same biochemical sort of hit that you get from joining a choir or making music in a group of human beings, but your social skills and your social network is not reinforced by them. So it's kind of like a pacifier. It does what a nipple does, but it's not nearly as satisfying.
When I was thinking about music and connections to people and interrelatedness, something that I like to do and something that people that I know like to do is go out and, for instance, well, once in a while do karaoke. But karaoke is something where you'll find that there's always one or two that are super keen, and then a whole bunch of other people get dragged along because that's what's going on. And then there's a couple of people that, whether they end up there or not, absolutely will not. It seems to be among the list of the top 10, kind of social phobias is being forced to sing in public. But it occurs to me, if from reading from some of the stuff that you're here, that this is a very new development. This is something that was very intrinsically part of our social culture until very, very recently.
There was there was a lot more bad music in the old days, but It was prevalent. It was one of the things that that we did to divert ourselves. There wasn't any TV, you know. People sat around and told stories, or you know, played board games, or you know, made music with simple musical instruments, fiddles and mouth organs, and you know, washboard basses and stuff like that, guitars, and you know, maybe the standard wasn't nearly as high as your average indie band, but you know, it was something that maybe as many as 70%, 80% of people participated in some way, and many evenings a week, and so it was a vehicle for social connection. And also, there's the biochemical aspect of it. When you create music with another person, the trust hormone oxytocin is released, and you bond with them in a very close way, which is something that doesn't happen with you know, pre-recorded music, because of course you're listening to it alone.
I'm wondering about how, when people go to use these sorts of technologies, let's move more kind of back up to the present time now, and we're talking about things like Facebook and Twitter and that sort of idea. Uh-huh. When you, for instance, when you sign up for the now more or less defunct website, for instance, MySpace, for instance, you would immediately get a friend request from this gentleman named Tom, who's the creator of this site, and it seems to be on its face they aren't being disguised. I guess what I'm trying to say is they aren't being disguised as actual, taking the place of actual relationships. They don't appear to attempt to be replacing them, but they essentially have. Why do you think that inner relationships that are clearly not the same as the types of relationships you'd have with someone in that you actually knew, like a friend? How do you think this sort of obviously fake sort of social network has so successfully replaced actual relationships?
There's a whole bunch of things going on. There are less opportunities to meet people in meaningful ways, and to create friendships. Friendships require time, and not everybody has time, because or very few people have time, because we're all busily trying to pay for those labor-saving devices. But as we became acclimatized and acculturated to isolating ourselves in the urban setting, because we have so many daily contacts that we can't manage them all, we're really only wired, some people say for 120 or 150, we're really only wired for that many people in our immediate community. And if, you know, I don't know where you're living in Toronto, downtown Toronto, I mean, you see that many people if you leave your office and go out to buy a cup of coffee and come back, you know. You need to distance yourself, because you just can't handle it. There's a kind of overload. And so one way of handling it evolved in the 60s, which was kind of a very brief sort of recognition and then turning away. But even that, you know, in the modern city can, you know, consume all of your emotional energy for the whole day long. So now, you know, you walk through the streets with earphones in your ears, or, you know, staring into an iPhone, at texting someone you're close to. And this isolates you from making these contacts in the city. But those contacts are actually, you know, an opportunity to make friends. And so our opportunities to make friends are reduced. The social skills required to make friends are reduced. And our satisfaction and maybe acculturation to using these devices instead of using friends is increased. So although we often feel a lack, maybe kind of a hole in our lives, we don't know really what's supposed to go in there. And, you know, of course, what's supposed to go in there is lasting, meaningful social relationships, which are not always happy. Friends can be very annoying, but, you know, it's the proximity that counts. You know?
Yeah.
And, have that. I mean, you know, how many times has your best friend pissed you off? With, I don't know, just by saying overly personal things in public or something like that. You know, just
sure.
what friends do. You know, but we've kind of lost our tolerance for that. You know, whereas you know he does it three times, and then you think, okay, I got to get a new friend. Okay, you know, this guy is not what I thought he was. You know, so our, you know, the duration of friendships is greatly reduced. And I think the duration of friendships is reduced, began to become reduced when we lost our relationship to material goods. We don't keep, you know, hoard material goods and reuse them in a variety of different ways. Instead, we, you know, just throw them out, and we do the same thing with people. Why?
Would this be part of, I mean, you're talking a lot, you're talking about, you know, not valuing physical goods, and your previous book was talking a lot about planned obsolescence and just this, between the two of them, there's kind of a general theme of disregarding and throwing away objects, and also in the same sense, you know, to, well, it's easier to get rid of this friend or to get rid of this partner because I can just grab another one. Is it all part of the same mindset? Is it all part of just a disposable planet kind of mindset that we're all in?
Yeah, I think, you know, we've systematically shut down our empathy, and also we've shut down our sense of responsibility through time. So, you know, relationships are no longer things to be grown. Material goods are no longer things to be crafted and cherished. You know, things that acquire a patina over time, they're things to be replaced. And I think, you know, the reason we do this is because we've assigned a monetary value to almost everything in our lives. And with that kind of one-dimensional worldview of consumerism, we don't see we don't stop and smell the roses anymore. You know, we don't value a sunset, although we might value it during our commute out of the car window for 5 minutes before we get home, and you know, throw ourselves down on the couch in front of the TV.
We do stop and watch the cat video. We just may not stop for the roses.
And you know, we've impoverished ourselves, you know, and it's very sad. And other, you know, parts of the world where people are much, much poorer than us in terms of material goods, they're actually much richer in terms of you know, their personal connections and the satisfaction of the quality of their life, you know. And I find this. I mean, when I returned, I started writing Made to Break when I came back from the Arab world in 2001, and just was really struck by the, I don't know if I can say this on your radio.
If you can't, we'll edit it out.
Oh, okay, good. Well, the sort of FU next, you know, or, you know, the sort of a complete lack of conversation or exchange while you're, you know, in a retail outlet buying something, and sort of, you know, get through this transaction as quickly as possible, supersize it if you can, and then, you know, get on to the next one. Whereas, you know, in the Arab world, you're playing a game with a person who's selling you something, you know, even if it's for a few pennies, you know, and you're establishing this kind of clever social connection that carries on into, you know, the next exchange, you know.
So one of the things we've talked about now is we've talked about some of the social disconnectedness. We've talked about how that applies to, you know, old technology, new technology, and sort of this path of increasingly being disconnected towards both people and objects around us. So what I want to ask you now is okay. So I mean, you've got a good example, I think, from a minute ago of just the idea of a disposable mentality and just sort of throwing things away and not thinking and not valuing the individual object, but simply in a way almost valuing its function, but not its form. In that its form can be replaced. But so what are the actual consequences then? I guess to that, we say, okay, I've been convinced. So what?
Oh well, gee. Well, they're massive. You know, I don't know. I don't know whether it's my age or you know, I'm 59, turning 60, and I'm just starting to, you know, reach out for the first time in many years to make new friends and sort of build a community around me and my family, which is, you know, it's possible to do, but it's very time-consuming, and so, you know, you have to change your priorities completely. But also, you know, the consequences are disastrous, not just in a personal term. They're disastrous in terms of our physical well-being and you know, our ability to survive the future. You know, so there is this, I mean, I don't think, you know, even the most fundamental people in the United States deny climate change anymore. It's pretty there are megastorms lashing the coast, and there are, you know, tornadoes coming down many miles of, north of Tornado Alley in January, you know, and much more powerful tornadoes that have ever existed before. There are all kinds of things happening. The Arctic ice cap is melting. You know, the sea levels are rising much quicker than you know than we have ever experienced before. And you know, I don't know what year the drought in the southwest during the United States is. It must be the fifth year of full drought now, but it was very bad last year, and it's going to be even worse this year. And so we've set ourselves on this course in order to, you know, achieve this level of material comfort that that's, you know, the basis of consumerism, but that also impoverishes our lives because it eliminates a kind of interpersonal dimension. We've set ourselves on this course where we're actually threatened as a species, and all species are actually threatened. And so it's disastrous and frightening. And we haven't yet woken up to the full implications of it. And I think the full implications are what my next book, American Exodus, will be about in North America as the you know, as climate change ramps up during the coming decade. A lot more Americans will be considering moving into the northern states and then crossing the border into Canada, as Mexicans and Latin Americans have been crossing the border into the United States since maybe about 1982. So the massive migration that has come into the United States from Mexico and Latin America, I think, will have a second stage to it, and Canada will see an explosion in its North American immigrant population very soon.
So just with the last minute or so here to go, I know you've...
Sorry, I ran out of the mouth.
No, that's fine. we've got you had an opportunity there to talk about your book that's coming up, which is American Exodus. I'm very interested to hopefully get a chance to take a look at it. I'm interested in it hadn't occurred to me the concept of there suddenly being a massive immigration to Canada due to climate change, but I guess it makes a lot of sense. Before we leave everybody here, I like to always try and turn the knob up a little bit right at the end there. We've got some serious issues here, you know, about just the idea about social disconnectedness and everything. And while you were talking, I was thinking about, you know, when we sit and gripe, at least here, you know, with my friends, talking about, you know, there seems like there's all this information about there, the environment's in a terrible state, but there's really, you know, there's stuff we can do about it. Why isn't anybody paying attention? You know, why isn't anybody doing anything? Maybe they just don't understand. But I think you've revealed another layer there, which is that I think there's a good chance that many, many people are perfectly aware of what's going on. They've just become so socially numb to it. Because it's easier. And I think that's sort of like within the theme of what you're talking about it's, you know, it's easier to have Facebook friends than real ones because they're, you know, not as much access to disappoint you. They don't take as much time to keep, you know, it's just more efficient.
It's easier to get rid of them too.
Sure. You know, the whole process is easier, but I think you've made a good point there that while it is easier, we lose something in the process. And I think we've given some good examples of that. With your newest book that's coming out sort of as a finishing point, I want you just to give us a little bit of hope maybe here at the end so we've identified a problem and I was wondering if you might have identified any solutions. What can we do to start fixing this without, you know, destroying all technology and starting over as a civilization?
Start scrubbing the atmosphere, I think, almost immediately, maybe as of yesterday. Plant a lot more trees that aren't subject to pine beetles. Consider where, you know, the wettest and coolest areas are going to be over the next 10 or 20 years. And then get a really solid estimate of... I think the carbon in the atmosphere is now at 395 parts per million. It needs to be, and it was before the Industrial Revolution, down at 280 parts per million. Some people say it needs to be 340 parts per million. How do we get it back there? How do we stop these, you know, carbon producing processes, switch to, you know, a different kind of fuel, and which different kinds of fuels are available? And how do we do all this in short order, you know, in a global sense? I mean, we really got to devote ourselves to that.
I'm afraid we are out of time, but Giles Slade, I would want to thank you very much for getting you on the phone today. And of course, we'll if you are coming to us via the Alternatives Journal article, there will, of course, be links to his work up there. If you're coming to us from elsewhere, there will be links on the Green Majority site as well. And once again, just want to thank you for your time.
All right. Thank you, Dan.